to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Scott Craven back to talk with you about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott, a UW Extension wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor. As a matter of fact, he stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. We'll look a little bit at flooding today, what it might do to wildlife. Talk about the fall hunting and bird regulations that are here. The seasons are here pretty quickly. In fact, bear season opened today for hunting. You can join in the conversation. Maybe you've got an interesting sighting. Maybe you've got a question. Maybe you've got a great photo. You can email the photos to us at ideas@wpr.org. And Kate Archer Kent, our engineer, and Jill Nadeau, our producer, will make sure that Scott and I get a look at it. And we can comment on it. So go there. Ideas@wpr.org if you've got a question or a photo. Or call us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Hello, Larry, and to all our listeners, it's always good to be back. I hate to see summer slip away so quickly, but what the heck? I mean, the weather's beautiful here in the fall so far.
I had my umbrella out on my way over to the station this morning. It's, what's the rain done for wildlife here in the state? I'm sure there may be some research on this long term. It's pretty hard to tell right off the top.
It's kind of hard to tell, and it is pretty localized. Even though the headlines are made by the places that are underwater. I called up north where our cabin is last night, and they hadn't had much rain at all. We're expecting some last night, so the northern part of the state is a little closer to normal. But down here in the Banana Belt, where we've had that all the way up to that all-time historic rain in Cross Plains of over 14 inches a week and a half ago, obviously there's been some things that are in the way of the flood that have just been swept away, but the sustained and long rain has led to lush vegetation. There seems like there are rabbits everywhere enjoying the vegetation. The amphibian population seems to be thriving. We go out every night at 10 o'clock and count the tree frogs on the garage door and toads and green frogs and everything else in the water garden. So some things have probably benefited. Some things locally may have suffered the same kind of tragic demise that, you know, other things have fallen victim to. But for the most part, in the long run, it probably hasn't made a whole lot of difference.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, you know, there are a lot of hunting seasons that are opening up soon. And Keith in Woodboro has something that relates to one of those seasons, I expect. Keith, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm calling about the grouse population, and, you know, the DNR and the experts are saying that there's such a low count, and why are we trapping grouse and sending them off to
Missouri? I saw that yesterday in the paper, and I'm thinking, wow, somebody's going to be upset about this. Because if they happen to be trapping, you know, next door to your property, someone might get a bit agitated. But the reality, Keith, is that the 300 birds they're talking about trapping in the bigger scheme of things in Wisconsin is a pretty trivial number. And so that really doesn't matter, again, unless there's a very local impact. And I think they're cognizant of that. So they said they were going to spread the trapping out over 3, 4, 5 counties and over various land types and whatnot. So I don't think that'll make a whole lot of difference. But it did seem a little like poor timing in terms of everyone's concern over grouse, which is on our list. Larry and I want to talk about that a little more today in terms of what's going on with the grouse population.
Well, and let's just
let's
do it now. What about it?
So here's the deal in a nutshell is that a year ago, leading into the 2017 season, There was a lot of rhetoric in the spring that grouse drumming counts were up. I think at that point, a year and a half ago, was about a 17% increase in the Northwoods in prime grouse range. And this seemed to suggest or support what everybody thought was that we were up on the upswing of the 10-year cycle, so that we were on the 5-year climb to good grouse populations. And there was a lot of talk, oh, it's going to be a good grouse season. Everybody was excited. Well, it didn't turn out to be.
No.
Last fall, there was a lot. I had lots of people up in and out of my cabin, and they had a hard time finding any birds. And in talking or trying to talk to as many people as I could up there across the Northwoods who were grouse hunting, and people who I knew were competent and had good dogs and so forth, it ranged from, wow, we just felt guilty after a week or two of shooting the few adult birds we were finding, so we just flat out quit hunting, to, yeah, we found some pretty good pockets of birds here and there. So it was a mixed bag, but overall, it was pretty disappointing. So everybody was still optimistic that, well, this spring, you know, it'll bounce back, and we're still on the upswing. But lo and behold, it didn't. It was down 34%. Down 34%.
Down,
yeah. Wasn't up at all. So all of a sudden, there was a lot of head-scratching. One data point doesn't make for much of a trend, but there were a couple of other wrinkles. Number one, we thought we should be going the other way.
Yeah.
There was a pretty crummy spring in terms of very late snowfall and other bad weather. That's usually not good for spring nesting birds. And then number three, all of a sudden, there was word from some other states that there was concern, not verified in Wisconsin yet, that West Nile virus might be a problem for grouse. Might be.
Yeah.
And that got everybody pretty nervous. The upshot of the whole thing for Keith or anyone else who's concerned, and there are a lot of people around the state who are concerned, is that we don't know.
Yeah.
The experts don't know, the managers don't know, but there is great concern. And there's been a flurry of activity, starting with some a move through the Natural Resources Board to close the grouse hunting season earlier than normal to prevent that late harvest of potentially nest birds that may survive until nesting next spring, an early closure in the grouse season, a fair bit of research interest in this to answer this question of whether West Nile is in the birds and whether it's having a problem, and just general concern. So this will be a pivotal season in terms of what they learn and what happens over the next 8 or 10 or 12 months. But I just desperately hope that it's not a disease issue.
Yeah.
Because if we're faced here in Wisconsin with CWD in the deer herd, which we all know is a horrific mess, and then all of a sudden what I would argue is our number one most famous game bird in the state that draws people from all over the country, if there's a disease issue there, when we hope there isn't, then that's a double whammy for Wisconsin.
I think I heard, now correct me if I'm wrong on this, but if, say, you're out in the woods and you come upon a dead grouse, that the DNR may be interested in taking a look at that bird, you know, one that hasn't been shot and so forth.
Right. And there were stories last year of dogs picking up emaciated birds and so forth, and just things that you just don't normally see.
Yeah, so something to keep in mind. Keith, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. And, Scott, as long as we're on that, you know, talking grouse, reminds me of the other seasons. There's lots of hunting seasons opening right now or pretty soon. Usually, I think pheasants open around middle of October, thereabouts.
Well, as we speak, Larry, the bear season opened today.
Today.
Yeah. So bear season opened today, and for the bear hunters, they know who has first opportunity, the ones who hunt with dogs or the ones who hunt with bait. And this year, I think it's the bait hunters. But anyway, bear season opened today. Last Saturday was a big opener with the early goose season, the early teal season, and the mourning dove season. And on the 15th of September, there'll be another big opening with the archery bow season and fall turkeys and a few other odds and ends. And then we go up to mid-October before, as you mentioned, the pheasant season opens and and on up to deer season in November. So there's there will be many opportunities coming online over the next couple of months.
Let's take another call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Dave in Orfordville, your turn. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Larry. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Great show. Hey, I just have a question. I have noticed this year the proliferation of Japanese hops. I found out about it because we do some work in the Driftless area, and over there the DNR guys are always wanting people to report if they see any of it, especially along trout streams. But do we have like an eradication program in Wisconsin, or is there something people can do to get rid of it? Because here in Rock County, the stuff is just everywhere.
I'm not altogether sure what the plant is that you're referring to. The one with the Japanese term in it that's around my place in southern Dane County that I've been worried about is Japanese hedge parsley, and I wonder if there's another name for it. You're calling it Japanese hops.
What does it look like?
It's a vine that looks, it's got a leaf, it's like a five-lobed leaf, and the vine grows over the top of everything.
It has a kind of a white flower?
Yeah, it has a white flower that kind of spikes up in the air kind of thing.
That's a wild cucumber. Yeah.
Now, it's been a tremendous year for wild cucumber. In fact, my wife asked me about it the other day. I was driving down 39 from Minocqua. There are places along the big potato fields where it's just formed essentially like somebody draped a carpet over the trees. But that's wild cucumber. The scientific name is Echinocystis lobata. It has a funny-looking squishy fruit on it. But it's as far as I know, that's been around forever. I think that's a native plant.
Yeah, and it has years when it's better, and this past year was a really good year. The spring, because of the spring we had, there were a lot of bare spots, and wild cucumber sits in the soil, and when it has some openings, it comes in, and we had a bad spring, so other ground, and I'm repeating what another expert told me. When there's open patches, the wild cucumber, seeds and goes in. Now, next year, depending on how the spring looks, you might not see any of it.
Bottom line, Dave, if there's another plant out there, I'm just not an expert in invasive plants. If you can describe, well, you did describe it, and we think it's wild cucumber, but there are certainly other vine-like plants that are on the invasive species list. I just don't know if you could, I don't know, maybe send a photo, maybe we can confirm this. Some identity
sure
issues,
cucumber.
But anyway, there you have it.
Yeah, just if you've got a photo, send it to ideas@wpr.org, and we'll get an ID on it. But I'm pretty sure it's wild cucumber. I'm hoping it is, because I'm hoping it's not something else. Oh, boy. Scott in Dykesville, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I just wanted to report it's just an observation, and recently you've been hearing all this stuff about cougar sightings around the state. And I live, just south of the Door County border. And about 2 weeks ago, we were basically in the car, saw this brown, I thought it was a smaller deer. At first I looked, and sure enough, it was a cougar. And what really gave it away was a long brown tail.
It's pretty hard to miss that tail.
Across the road.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there have been some sightings over in that area.
There have been persistent sightings, especially in the eastern counties. And, like you say, it's pretty hard to mistake that tail that looks like a hairy baseball bat. And with the new Snapshot Wisconsin program and all the folks with game cameras out, it's been easier to document these things. So Larry and I are not the doubting Thomases we used to be 15 or 20 years ago. So, hey, if you got to see one, more power to you. And I'd make sure your local DNR folks know about the sighting.
I think she went online and did report it in their reporting site.
Okay, good. Well,
so she did that, but it kind of took me aback because when I saw that, you know, up in Door County, you know, I've heard there's been wolves up there for years, but it was sure enough a cougar.
Well, it sounds like that one made a wrong turn around Green Bay or De Pere and got up on the peninsula where he's going to have to turn around and go back, because most of them are just moving through the state and end up who knows where to the east of us.
Yeah. So, and as we've often reported, the one that went through Wisconsin that was killed, what, out east in New York or someplace?
Yeah, some of them made it all the way to New England, and so they're on the move.
Yeah, they're on the move. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. And we've got an email sent a picture. Someone sent a picture of what Japanese hops looks like.
Well, that's not wild cucumber.
That is not wild cucumber.
So they may have a similar growth form, but that's not the plant that Larry and I were talking about. And I've not personally seen that one. And I guess from Dave's description, I hope I don't, especially around my property. So I don't know what to say about this one, Dave, if you're still listening, but that's not wild cucumber. I don't know of, generally for all of these relatively new invasive plants, on specific properties or in specific places, there may be some effort to control them, but in terms of some wide-scale spraying or pulling effort, it's a tough nut to crack, and I'm not aware of any kind of massive program to control this or anything else. The big emphasis right now seems to be on aquatic invasives and all the programs to clean boats and talk to people at the boat ramps and that kinds of things. These terrestrial things that may be on roadsides or along streams are very difficult to deal with.
Yeah. We'll bring that up the next time we have DNR folks on who talk about these kinds of invasive species. And Jill, make a note of that, to ask about Japanese hops, will you? Okay. She'll make a note of that. We'll get it done. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Kate Archer-Kent, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Here on the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Wildlife Ecologist Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Give a call with your questions, comments, or maybe your wildlife experience that you want to share at 800-642-1234. Got some photos you want to send in or questions, you can also either email them to ideas@wpr.org. Pete in Reedsburg emailed to say the grouse hunting community has speculated that the burgeoning population of turkeys may explain the drop in grouse numbers, which is a problem in more places than Wisconsin. Any thoughts on that?
Well, my initial response would have been, well, you know, there's been concern about the growing turkey population causing problems for just about everything on the landscape, but none of that that I'm aware of has materialized with any scientific study or backdrop. In most cases, the populations in question are all doing well, and therefore people are not concerned. Now, having said that, within the last month or so, I did have an individual describe a case where they had witnessed a turkey apparently pecking away at a nest and pecking some eggs. Whether that, I really can't say that that's particularly widespread, but or whether that was just an accident or, again, a case of mistaken identity. But that, among the variety of things that the experts, the grouse biologists, are talking about as problems, turkeys haven't made the list yet that I'm aware of.
Okay, there we go. Well, Dave in Richland Center again. Dave, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, David. Calling about that vine, the Japanese hops.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. It really is one of the newer invasives to Wisconsin. It covers bushes, trees, whole riversides. It's a big problem in southeast Minnesota and southwest Wisconsin. It's an annual, so it spreads its seeds every year. It's a very different flower than the regular native hops. But it is quite aggressive, and I invite people to look at the DNR Invasive Plants website or other ways to just look up that plant, Japanese hops.
Well, and that's really it, with these plants, it's really a matter of convincing property owners and whatnot. When they see these things as they're first getting established, they have a chance of keeping a lid on it. But once it's widespread, it's a real
challenge. Yeah. But David, thank you very much for calling. The DNR website at Invasives, if you want to take a look at that, you'll get some pretty good pictures of Japanese hops, what they look like. Thank you again. Eric in New London has something for us. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I have a question. Last winter, I was out, and the ice was just starting to form on a creek, and you could see where an otter had been playing, jumping in and out of the ice. And then as I looked further downward, the ice was solid. The otter was laying there, and I hiked down the bank, and sure enough, it was dead. The only thing I can figure is, as I hiked down the bank, eagle flew out of the tree. Would an eagle have attacked? It was a pretty good-sized otter. You know, it was at least 4 feet laying there. Would an eagle have attacked and killed an otter?
Maybe, but did you examine the carcass at all? Did, when you say you hiked down to it, was there blood on the ice, or was it just lying there dead?
It was lying there dead. You could see where it had gone, like, in circles, and I couldn't see ice or blood on the ice, but I was not about to hike out on the ice because it had just...
Well, yes, good idea, but, you know, that's a pretty big animal for an eagle to tackle. And obviously, an eagle's tools of subduing something include their talons and beak, but primarily the talons, and puncture wounds bleed. So I would have suspected, had it been the eagle or any other predator, that there would have been some sign of predatory attack. More likely, if I don't know what killed the otter, but if an animal were laying there dead and the eagle was patrolling the creek or whatever, which they're prone to do, they like fish and they're scavengers for the most part, then the eagle may have perched and had, oh, there, it looks like looks like free lunch today. Who said there's no free lunch? And then you spooked it off the site. I think that's the more likely scenario, but learned a long time that you, A, never say never, and, A, you never know for sure unless you actually witness something. But that would be an otter is both a big animal, a powerful animal, and if it's near or in the water, it would be a handful for anything.
I do. A listener sent us a video that she took at her cabin of an eagle attacking a fawn that was in the water and drowned it, mm-hmm. and then dragged it out of the water.
the eagle's got all the advantages if the thing is in the water and really isn't as at home in the water as an otter would be. So, what killed it?
Don't know.
Who knows?
Yep. There we go. Thank you, Eric, for calling. Let's go to Andy in Kenosha next. Hi, Andy.
Hi, gentlemen. Question about more common animals. I've got a problem with nuisance possums and raccoons in my property, and wondering if I can release them, and if I release them, how far should they be released away?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, the live trapping issue is a popular way to deal with these things, but in my opinion, it presents a whole nother problem because now you have an animal captured and you're forced to make the decision you're asking about, which is what the heck am I going to do with it? In Wisconsin, release of nuisance animals like this, in terms of the legal aspects of it, require the permission of the property owner on the release site to release it. Now, I'm a realist in this matter, and I know there are hundreds, if not thousands, of animals that are caught under somebody's deck or out of their garage or whatever, and the idea is, hey, we'll drive it out of town, and the first nice green spot we come to, it'll live happily ever after. Well, that probably isn't the case, and in even taking them to, say, a DNR public hunting ground or wildlife area, again, that requires it's illegal. It requires the permission of the property manager to dump them there. And there's question about their survival when they're released. We like to think, oh, they will live happily ever after, but that's usually not the case. They tend to move a lot and therefore are subjected to highway mortality and all sorts of other things. The landscape's already full of raccoons and possums, and they may move. They have a history of being a problem. They'll come to the first farmhouse or neighborhood they get to, and they're going to be right back in somebody else's chimney or bird feeder. Bottom line is, although it's a tough decision for some people, even though they may be caught in a live trap on your own property, it is legal for you to euthanize them. How you choose to do that, this could get into a long discussion, yeah. But what kinds of problems are they causing for you, Andy? They're just around, or are they bothering gardens, or are they in the building, or what? Are you there?
I believe I have possums that have gotten underneath the garage.
Okay. Well, of the two animals, the possums are the easiest one to deal with because they're very slow moving. They have their reputation. Geez, the possums just aren't very bright. Well, that's a human term, but generally speaking, they don't have the wherewithal or the power that a raccoon does to dig out a barrier or chew into something or whatever else. So if there's an access under the garage where you can convince them to leave with some moth flakes or a rag with some ammonia on it or something else so that you know they're out of there, a little bit of hardware cloth and a little bit of effort to screen that off, and your possum problem is solved. They'll go elsewhere, and you don't have to worry about catching them or doing anything else. Raccoons, on the other hand, are much more powerful and can tear into something that you might try and block them out of. So in that case, I think the live trapping and ultimately either seeking permission or to remove them somewhere or euthanizing them once you've caught them is the way to go with the raccoons. Either way, as we enter into winter here, which sadly is not too far away, the possums are going to disappear in cold weather. And the raccoons won't be particularly active either, except during thaws. So who knows what's going to happen to them on their own over winter. Your problem may take care of itself by next spring.
There you go. Thanks, Andy, for calling. And Keith in Mineral Point, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. I'm calling to ask about salamanders.
Okay.
And their life stages.
Mm-hmm.
And what I can do to discourage them from living in proximity of myself.
They're in your basement?
Yeah.
Huh.
Salamanders in the basement.
So is it pretty damp down there? Do you have a stone foundation or how?
I have a stone foundation, and with all the rain we've had, it's been damp.
Have you seen this problem before? Or do you think this is a function of all the rain?
I can see symptoms that I saw before, but I didn't realize what they were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, first of all, there are several species that are probably a possibility, but the most likely one and the most common in the southwestern part of the state is the tiger salamander. Have you seen them, Keith? Are they pretty good size, maybe 9, 10, 11 inches long?
The biggest ones I've seen are about 5 inches.
But they're pretty fat and thick, like your index finger?
Like a small baby finger.
Well, I still suspect, I mean, the possibilities are pretty limited, but you asked about their life cycle, so that they usually breed in very early spring, sometimes even with the first warm rains in February or early March, when they come out of the forest floor or your basement and head to a breeding pond, where they then breed, reproduce, and then the adults head back to the uplands to spend the summer down in the leaf litter or in mulch or compost or something like that, where they have some dampness. And then the eggs hatch in the pond, and the tadpole larvae, sort of analogous to, the salamander larvae, sort of analogous to a tadpole, but they look like small salamanders, whereas tadpoles don't look much like a frog. Those live and grow in the pond until mid to late summer, and then they metamorphose or turn into adult land-dwelling salamanders, and then they're off to the uplands too. And then they've got to find a secure place to spend the winter down in the soil, or again in your basement, which is probably figures a pretty good place. It's dark and relatively moist, and that's really what they're looking for. So the upshot of it is, first of all, Keith, I mean, they're completely harmless. They have no claws, no teeth, no poisonous secretions, nothing. So that one possibility is that as you see them, you simply scoot them into a bucket and, you know, take them down the road and dump them out in a wet ditch, and they'll go about their business. You can remove them as you find them. You can make it a little easier to find them by picking a spot on the floor in the basement where you've close to where you've seen them before, and put down a couple strips of 1x2 or 1x1 board and cover that with either an old tarp or a piece of cardboard or something like that. And then that will provide the environment that they're looking for, and it provides you with a gathering place to go down there, lift up the canvas, grab the salamanders, throw them in a bucket, and get rid of them like I described. Those are their two tactics if you want to remove them. If you don't want them in there in the first place, then it's the same solution I just described with the possums. If you know where or what direction they're approaching the building from, you can dig down a little bit and just put a little barrier of either sheet metal or hardware cloth or galvanized small mesh wire up against the stones, and they can't get in. Or if you have somebody just inspect the stonework and with a can of, you know, great stuff, spray insulation or a handful of steel wool, just plug up any crack or hole or crevice you see, you'll probably go a long way towards stopping the problem from happening.
Yeah, that makes really good sense.
And that's about the long and short of it. But in a normal dry year, I'd be surprised if they're even in there like they are. This is an extraordinary year. And you may not have the problem in the future, but I'd still, just to prevent insects, snakes, salamanders, or anything else, with a stone foundation, go around it yourself or have somebody go around it, every inch of it, and just quickly plug up any cracks or crevices or holes that you see.
Yeah. Good luck, Keith. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Steve and Ladysmith up next. Hi, Steve.
Thank you, guys. Say, just a real quick question on turtles. Will they have a litter of turtles, or whatever you might call it, some that are born this late in the year? And my morning jog, I go by a very nice pond, and alongside the road, I saw one yesterday morning that was no bigger than a just born, maybe a half a dollar or less.
Sure. They will emerge from their nests easily well into September, depending on how warm it stays. So that the turtles nest usually in June. That's when you see most of them, the females, out along the roads and whatnot. So they nest in June, bury their eggs, and then the environment incubates them. I mean, the female turtle's long gone. The eggs are left in the ground. They're incubated by sunshine and warmth in the soil, and then they usually hatch, depending on how early the nesting was, from maybe mid-August to perhaps late September, even into October if we haven't had a freeze. And at that point, once they've hatched, they're down in this goblet-shaped nest, maybe as many as a couple dozen or more in the case of snapping turtles, and they're sitting there. And if it's hot and dry, it's hard for them to dig their way out, so they wait for rain. That loosens up the soil, and then they dig out, and boom, they're off. It's a race then to get to water. And that's when you see all these little, you know, nickel or quarter-sized turtles. Some of them, if the conditions aren't right, they'll stay in that nest over winter and then emerge in the spring when the soil gets soft. So when people see these little turtles first thing in the spring and think, wow, they're hatching early this year, no, that's not really the case. Those are last year's turtles that are just coming out. Anyway, the way this year's been, I mean, the soil is goo. So they may have more trouble getting out in this mud than they would have if conditions had been right. So if you found a nest in reasonably sandy soil, especially along a road cut bank or whatever, those are turtles from this past June's nesting that are now emerging and heading for the pond.
Oh, there you go. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the call. Gary in Boscobel, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Thank you, Larry. I wanted to make a couple of comments, one about the grouse and the other about the Japanese hops.
Yeah.
I've been really interested in what happened to the grouse and have covered almost the whole Driftless area doing photography and trying to find rough grouse, interviewed biologists in the CETA, and traveled grouse areas after snowfall to look for tracks and have seen very few. And the one commonality that always seems to come up is that grouse and woodcock and whippoorwills are all ground nesting birds, and all three of those species are kind of on a downhill slide. And at the same time, prices for furs, especially raccoon, really have bottomed out, and we've got the most common roadkill you see is either possums or a raccoon. So we've got ground predators looking for something to eat. Plus, we've got photographic evidence of deer eating chicks out of nests, and we've got a burgeoning deer population. So I'm just wondering whether the animals out there that are looking for things to eat really have an advantage over these ground nesting birds. And on the Japanese hops, one of the problems with trying to deal with some of these terrestrial invasives is if they get started along a roadway, you can just about wave goodbye to any kind of control efforts due to the fact that the highway crews who do the mowing along these roads spread that seed from one side of the state to the other and from north to south. And the only way we'll ever be able to combat that kind of spread of these invasive species on road right-of-ways is to educate and require maintenance men to be able to identify these species and act accordingly, for instance, with spraying or avoid mowing those plants when they're in seed to spread that all over. And there's a whole long list of invasive species that are found along the roadside. So it's a terrible problem. So thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, appreciate it, Gary. Thanks for calling.
Well, good comments. First of all, as far as the roadsides are concerned, he's absolutely right. Most of our rural roadsides are a soup of bad plants.
Yeah.
And plants that spread aggressively. So that's a fact of life, and mowing and roadside maintenance have been an issue. When I started with Extension back in the late 70s,
yeah,
there were roadside programs jointly between Extension and the DNR to try and limit mowing. And I mean, that was almost 50 years ago,
yeah,
and we haven't made a whole lot of headway. As far as the grouse are concerned, I just want to make the distinction that there's a huge difference between what happened to our grouse in southwestern Wisconsin in the Driftless area and what's perhaps going on in the North Woods. In the Driftless area, there was some what I would call elegant research done by Scott Walter when he was at UW-Richland Center and then with the Grouse Society, and now he's the carnivore biologist for the DNR. But working out of Richland Center, they did some really neat work over a number of years and pretty well documented that the demise of grouse in southwestern Wisconsin was due to maturing habitat, changes in land use, and a whole host of other things, including certainly predators and people,
yeah,
and all have,
sure,
an impact. But the big change there was habitat change. In the North Woods, the stronghold of grouse really in Wisconsin, yes, predators are still an issue. They always will be. But grouse and those predators have evolved together. I mean, in the far north, into Canada, where the 10-year cycle is very strong, it's predators that drive that cycle. It's more muted in Wisconsin, but sure, they have an effect, but I don't believe that that's currently what's going on. So,
all right.
Anyway.
Gary, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Give a call with your questions at 1-800 642-1234. Email us your photos and questions at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Gary in Mindoro has a question for us, so let's go there. Gary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm amazed by the wealth of knowledge that I'm hearing on this. I'm a trapper, and I have some questions about the bobcats, what their populations might be in southern Wisconsin, because I catch a few. It's really hard to get a tag, and I just want to know if you guys had any ideas on what the population of bobcats might be.
Okay.
Well, first of all, it's certainly been expanding. I mean, when I started on the job, well, it seems like a century ago. I mean, there were no bobcat records in southwestern Wisconsin, and even one passing through was considered a real oddity. Now, they seem to have established a pretty good foothold, and they've been radio-collared in the southwestern part of the state as part of that big deer study that the DNR is doing. And my recommendation, Gary, if you haven't seen it, I think mine came yesterday, but grab the most recent issue of Outdoor News, the outdoor publication that's pretty widely distributed in Wisconsin, and there was a big spread in there on bobcats in the southwest. They have 22 of them collared now. One woman had caught four, I think, on her property.
Wow.
So they're clearly around. They're part of the quota system now. They describe that and how the quota for bobcat take is split between the primary range in the north and the rest of the state. So they're there. They seem to be doing well. And my suspicion is, you know, if you sort this all out over decades, things change. And in the southwest, hey, the grouse disappeared. Now there's bobcats. Well, that's a reflection of just things changing.
Yeah.
And it benefits some species, and it's a detriment to others. But in any event, grab that most recent issue of Outdoor News. I think you can even find it online, and it'll answer a lot of your questions.
Now, are you talking about the DNR?
Outdoor? No, I'm talking about the
Wisconsin Outdoor News,
the newspaper format that Dean Bortz is the editor of. And there's a big spread about how they're collaring them, what they're learning about them, and a whole host of other things. I think you'll find it pretty interesting.
There we go. And permits for them, the numbers of permits he was asking about,
I
have no idea on the permits.
I think that if I'm remembering what I saw last night in the paper, the quota for the southern part of the state or the southern range for bobcat permits was like 250 compared to 500 in the north, quite a few less. But I think the application deadline, at least for this coming winter, is long past as far as those are concerned.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Gary. Appreciate the call. Judy in Racine has a question. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Scott, you are a treasure. My question is probably kind of weird, but what critter bites the head off their prey and leaves it?
Yeah, is it, are you talking about chickens or?
No, it happened with a mouse and with a bird in our yard.
Okay.
If you'd said something larger, like a chicken or a rabbit, I would have said horned owl, which happens with some regularity. But for the smaller stuff, I'm really baffled by the mouse, because the mouse is so small that it's, for most predators, hey, it's a snack, and the whole thing's gone. But some of the larger rodents, like a rat, will occasionally take the head off, or some of the smaller weasels. So there are a couple of possibilities, and in that case, you know, the mouse surprises me a little bit, because they're so small that anything capable of catching and killing them would have just taken it, I would have suspected. Was it like a house mouse, a white-footed mouse, that kind of thing? Because
it was very small. It probably was a young one. I mean, it was just really...
Oh, really tiny. Well,
yeah.
I mean, that could have even been a blue jay or some type of a bird that will prey on a small mammal. And one of the main predators on those little guys, even in your garage or outside, is a short-tailed shrew, which eats mammals that are of equal size, including some of the mice, and, you know, that's a possibility too, and maybe even a little one was too much of a meal for it at that point. But
yeah,
quite a few possibilities.
Somebody told me,
we can't give you a firm answer.
Yeah, somebody on one of the shows called to say that they had observed a squirrel grab a bird and nail it in the head and kill it and eat it. So even squirrels.
It's a jungle out there. You've got to be careful at all times.
Thanks, Judy. Appreciate the call. Dawn in Sherwood emailed that she has a problem with Japanese hops in southeast Wisconsin. She's been battling them for years. But then she also sent a picture. She says urban turkeys are becoming a big thing. And she sent a photo of a flock of turkeys on the streets in Glendale. And I have photos of turkeys in my backyard and in the street in front of the house. They seem to like the urban area.
They're far more adaptable than anybody thought when they were reintroduced, and they do fine in an urban environment.
Yeah.
In fact, wildlife in the urban environment or the urban landscape is in some cases more abundant than it is in the wilds of Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, for sure. Ron in Fall Creek, let's go to you next. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi. I'm fairly new to the area, and we've got a lot of mounds in our yard. We were trying to cut the grass, and I mean, they seem to come up on a regular basis. Some of them are just fresh. It's almost like after the rain, you can go out there and there's two or three fresh mounds. I'm not sure what they are, and they're a couple feet apart or close together, but they're kind of a problem to get the grass cut around.
Do you see a hole or just a mound of dirt?
Well, if there's kind of an indent where there would be a hole coming up, but you don't see the hole, per se.
Well, I mean, the most likely culprit are moles. They're, especially this year with the soil moisture we've had, they've been close to the surface, doing a lot of digging and tunneling. I'm surprised you haven't seen some of the raised ridges that go from hole to hole or mound to mound where the grass is kind of pushed up a little bit. That would be a dead giveaway for moles. But moles push their dirt up from their digging straight up, and it kind of cascades down like a little miniature volcano, and you don't see the hole. There are a few other things that make small burrows. Even if you're near a wetland or a stream, some of the crayfish will push up a mound of dirt, but you'll see a hole. It looks more chimney-like than just the mound of dirt. But
ants will do it, too.
What's that?
Ants will do it, too.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, there's always an ant mound. If you see ants around, they tend to not be as tall as the as a mole mound, but that's another possibility.
Yeah. Yep, there we go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Mark in Menominee Falls next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Hey, so this goes along with the turkey comment that you guys had a little bit ago. And I'm in the Menominee Falls area, and I have a lot of city-dwelling wild turkeys. And I'm trying to encourage them on my property. I have about an acre that's pretty heavily wooded. And I was wondering if your guests could give me some guidance on encouraging the turkeys to stay on my property and just what I can do to enhance them living on my area.
Well, that's a good question. First of all, the most important thing to realize is that turkeys cover a lot of ground in the course of a day's activities. So there's, in my opinion, there's nothing you can do to keep them on an acre. There are some things you might be able to do to encourage that they use the acre period. They may visit. For example, if you were in a situation where you had some big old oaks or white pines in a corner of your acre with nice lateral limbs on them, they might find that a very nice place to roost, and they'd come there every night, even though they might be somewhere else during the day. That's one thing. If you had a water source, for example, in an otherwise relatively dry neighborhood, whether it's a water garden or a wildlife bubbler or some other water source. That might cause them to visit periodically. If you put in a little food plot that produced some grains or whatever, that might cause them to visit. I wouldn't feed them directly. That is probably something that people would think of first, since they're birds. Well, we'll put out a bird feeder. They may come to a normal bird feeder anyway and scratch at what's on the ground. But if you start throwing corn or large quantities of seed around for them, that'll attract more trouble than it's worth.
It'll attract other things.
It'll attract a lot of other things that you won't want around. So I don't recommend that. So, I mean, those are a couple ideas, but the very fact that you have an acre and you're willing to kind of leave them alone and tolerate them may cause them to visit anyway, just because it's security. So the roosting, the security, maybe some food, maybe some water, those are the basic components of their habitat.
Well, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have more callers online. Kim in Viroqua's got a question for us, but we are running out of time here for our news break. So we will remind you that Scott Craven's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today as he talks the world of wildlife with you. And you can join in, too, and I hope you will. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Scott Craven, our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. You, my friends, are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today, Larry Mueller here with my guest Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Great to have him back. Thanks for listening in. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Kim's been waiting a while from Viroqua, so let's go there. Kim, hi. Thank you for calling. And what's on your mind? Kim, are you there? Maybe we lost Kim.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Well, okay. She wondered, where are the chipmunks in northern Wisconsin?
Oh. You mean, are there chipmunks in northern Wisconsin, or where are they?
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. So we have two species of chipmunks in the state, the common eastern chipmunk, which is everywhere around here and in northern Wisconsin, but also in mixed hardwood forests in the extreme northern part of the state, we have a little guy called the least chipmunk, which looks
that
like...
That is a little guy.
Yeah, right. Well, hence the least chipmunk. But anyway, they look like the bigger ones, except the stripes go all the way down to the base of their tail. But anyhow, two species of chipmunks. The least chipmunks are pretty rare. The eastern chipmunks are all over the place.
And someone called in and wondered, I'm trying to find where that is. It was about a cookbook, and it was Nancy in Duluth called to ask the name of the game cookbook that you recommended the last time you were on. It has an alligator on the cover. She's tried online and can't find it.
Okay, well, it's called After the Hunt. After the Hunt. Simple title, After the Hunt. And the author is Chef John Folse, F-O-L-S-E, Folse. And it's published in Louisiana. It has always been available on Amazon. I mean, it's a huge book. It's gigantic, and it's very heavy. But anyway, that's it. After the Hunt with the alligator on the cover and John Folse. I haven't looked for it lately because I've had my copy for a number of years, but hopefully she can find it.
And you really like that book.
Oh, it's a great book.
Yeah, wonderful book. Okay. You have a Yellowstone winter trip coming up, do you not?
Well, yes, and we talked about this last year at about this time. I was supposed to help lead this tour of Yellowstone National Park during the winter last February, and, of course, my gallbladder decided otherwise, and I couldn't make the trip. But my good friend Paul Renier, who heads up Door County Tours up in Door County, decided it went so well last year, even in my absence, that he wanted to do it again. So coming up this winter from February 26th to March 4th, the name of the tour is Yellowstone National Park, Cool Winter Hotspots and Wild Western Wildlife. and that's the name of it. And we'll be in the park, I think, for 4 days, headquarter in Bozeman, Montana, to start with, then go into the park. It's not like we're going to be crawling in through snowdrifts. This will be on snow cats, and we'll stay at the Snow Lodge next to Old Faithful. It's a pretty neat deal. They did have a great time last year. I saw the pictures that the attendees took that they created kind of an album of, and I mean, it's
fabulous.
It's pretty all year, yeah. But it's spectacular in the winter. And it's not a hardship, whatever. It's people will be comfortable if you dress appropriately and all. All that information goes out to the attendees before we leave. The highlights include a number of guided explorations by minibus, snow coach, or on foot with professional guides. You'll see all the geothermal features, Old Faithful erupting, but in the snowy landscape.
Oh, man, it's got to be something.
It's pretty cool. They did see wolves last year, and there'll be a trip with the Yellowstone Forever naturalists to find wolves and other more elusive wildlife. And these animals that come down out of the high country to be down around the geothermal features and stay warm and food, warm and find food, include bighorns and bison and elk and all sorts of stuff. Plus, we'll be at Old Faithful, which is pretty neat in its own right. So there's a lot of neat stuff. It's about a week out there, all told. And for folks who want more information about the Yellowstone National Park trip, and again, that was from February 26th to March 4th, they should contact Paul at Door County. It's a pretty easy email address, doorcountypaul@gmail.com, or they can call 920-493-1572.
920-493-1572.
Yes, and it's limited to 13 travelers, plus Paul and myself, and so there's not a lot of space. If it's couples, for example, you know, barely six or seven couples, but they had a great time last year. I'm looking forward to it. I don't have a gallbladder anymore to go south on me, so things are looking promising. So it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. If you're interested,
yeah,
you know, you can get to me through you, or go right to Paul. He's doing the sign up and the
what's it? It's Paul. No, what's the address again?
The email address? Door County Paul, all one word, @gmail.com.
Oh, simple enough.
Simple enough.
Carissa in Green Bay has something for us. Hi, Carissa.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
My husband and I enjoy hiking all over the state of Wisconsin, and we've got a couple comprehensive field guides, but we're finding a lot of species that aren't in there, and that includes mushrooms, butterflies, you name it, plants especially. Do you have a better recommendation for a field guide that you'd recommend that we'd actually be able to identify these plants and these animals?
There's more than one field guide.
Generally speaking, the field guides are specific to individual groups. If you're out and about, as far as the birds and mammals are concerned, and especially if you're interested in being able to interpret sign, not necessarily finding the animal, but finding tracks, droppings, dens, things like that, then Paul Elbrocht's book, Elbrocht, one's called Mammal Tracks and Sign, and one's called Bird Tracks and Sign. And with those two, plus a basic Peterson field guide to either eastern birds or mammals, you'll have everything you need. On the plant side, and then on the reptile and amphibian side, the DNR little handbooks that you can get from any DNR office for $3 a piece will cover everything you wanted to know about the herpetiles. So that takes care of the animal issue. On the plant side, I'm trying to think of what I would consider a favorite. There are, of course, the Peterson field guides and a variety of others, but the... Larry, help me out here.
I'm trying to think of there's a guy who's got a book on the mushrooms of Wisconsin, and I can't think of the if you put in the mushrooms of Wisconsin book, maybe Kate can find that for us.
Plus, there's Rich Henderson's guide to natural communities that's pretty neat and goes by community type. There's another book I sort of like. It's called, I think it's Northwoods Wildlife, which is a guide to a whole bunch of different stuff, and I don't remember the author.
But it's Northwoods Wildlife.
Yes. But the plant one has me stuck. But I think that the best place to go, okay, here's the deal. Go to one of the big nature centers, like Bay Beach and Green Bay, Mosquito Hill. What's the one up near Eau Claire? I'm drawing a blank. But find a big local nature center, and most of them have gift shops with a nice selection of natural history books, and you should be able to find what you want there.
I hope that helps, Carissa. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Gary in Janesville will give you a shot. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I got a question. Another guy called in talking about mounds earlier. Mine are ant mounds. I have about 6 acres, and it hasn't been turned over in many years. I was trying to make a trail for giving my grandson a ride on my lawn tractor, but I kept running into roadblocks, you know. I tell you, one of them is about, I got an 88 Chevy pickup, and the anthill is as big as the hood of my truck and up to the bumper, you know.
Wow.
That's the biggest one. But I have several others. I just want to know the best way to try and get rid of them. After the grass dies, I'll be able to see them all.
I have a feeling this might be something Larry's talked about on other programs, yeah. So I'm going to defer to Larry here. Although I took one out that was bothering me in my front yard. I'm reluctant to use chemicals on stuff like that because ants serve a bit of a purpose, but in that case I used 7 insecticide, and it boom, the hill was gone.
What you need to do is you need to get down to the queen. So what you need to do, the best way to do it is to take a rod, a metal rod, and poke it right down as deep as you can into the center of the mound. Drive it down as far as you can, pull it back out, and there are chemicals that you can pour in that will get to the queen, as the queen is way down. And once you kill the queen, that's the end of it. So that's what Phil Pelletieri and P.J. Leash recommend for getting rid of those kinds of anthills. So there you go.
There you go.
And thanks a lot for calling, Gary. Appreciate your call. You just need a metal rod and probably a little hammer of some sort to drive it down there because they're way at the bottom, and you need to get to them. Steve in Platteville will give you a chance now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What have you got for us today?
Well, last November, we were hauling corn in. I was helping my uncle pick corn. I was hauling in loads on Highway 23 down in the valley below the house in the rock. And as I was driving by, I saw a big buck that got hit by a car laying down in the ditch. So we retrieved the buck, did a European mount on the head, and after we got done taking it out of the solution and dried it off and stuff, we discovered that it had canine teeth in the upper jaw. I was just wondering if Scott had any comments about that.
Canine teeth in the upper jaw.
Kind of like elk ivories, huh?
Yeah, they were right. They had, you could see right in the jaw where the incisor went right in, and one on each side about 3/4 of the way forward on the jaw. And they're they're probably a 1/2 inch long at best.
So, okay, so let me get this straight. So typically in a deer skull, you have the row of incisor teeth in the front, across the front, and then there's a gap called the diastema, and then you get back to the molars and premolars, which grind up their food. But within that gap between the incisors and the premolars, you had an extra tooth.
On each side, yep.
Wow. Well,
it had its own socket formed on the outside of the upper jaw. It was like looked like little vampire teeth coming down.
Wow.
Well,
we haven't seen that one before, have we, Scott?
I haven't seen that one, so I'm going to defer to my deer biologist friends, some of them who may be listening, to maybe give us a little insight into that. Typically, that's not the case, not part of their normal dental formula. Now, elk, on the other hand, which are a close relative, have those canines, which are called elk ivories and are a treasured trophy when somebody gets to harvest a bull elk. But I've certainly not seen them in any bucks I've harvested. And Larry, you shot a buck back in 87, wasn't it? Did you see the ivories?
No, I have not. I have never in the many that I have taken.
Oh, well.
Seen that.
That's a pretty neat observation, Steve. I don't know what to make of it.
Maybe somebody else will call
it. If somebody else can call and say whether they've seen that or not or what the reason might be for it, I'd be plenty curious. And
yeah,
I'm going to make a note, too, to check on it, and I'll pass it on to Jamie and David next time they're on next month.
Oh, that sounds perfect. Or if you've got some information on us, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Thanks, Steve. Interesting story there for sure. We had a number of listeners called to say the headless critter was probably the victim of a cat.
Yes, that's certainly possible, but you know how I feel about raising the cat question on the program, so we'll let that lie.
Yeah, but it could well be, that's for sure. Steve emailed to say he thinks with the mounds in the yard that one caller called in about,
mm-hmm.
after it rains, could be night crawlers. He had this a year ago.
And yeah, they'll certainly push up a little bit of casting, but that takes the form of, since that's passed internally, and then whatever, it has a little different look than just a mound of loose soil, but who knows? Anything's possible.
And Mary Jo in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hi. I have the, are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I have a pair of sandhill cranes that come to my backyard. One has a broken leg. It's like above the knee. And I just wondered if there was anyone that can help, I could call to get help for that. Or
yeah.
I've heard that happens a lot to them, and as long as they can still fly.
So what happened? One leg is kind of dangling loose, or is it just bent?
Right, and I can see above the knee, what I call the knee to the body, it's bent. So it's probably broken there. And it hops around.
Well, I mean, the first issue is, while there are people who would be concerned and might be able to help, catching the bird is going to be a problem, especially since it can still fly. The bird's not going to know someone's trying to help it. So that's one immediate problem. But you could call your local DNR office, and they maintain a registry of wildlife rehabilitators in your area. And you may find someone who wants to intervene or thinks they can. And if you're in Green Bay, I would also call the Bay Beach Sanctuary there and see if they may be able to steer you to somebody. But having said all that, these animals, especially with a broken bone, are, although it looks awful to a human observer, they have tremendous healing powers. And if it's not a compound, if it's not completely severed and a piece of the bone sticking out, they will knit back together, and it may walk with a limp or have a short leg, but there's a good chance that it may recover as long as it can get out of here before it frees up and get south. So
there you go. Thank you very much, Mary Jo, for calling. Appreciate it. John in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hey, just wanted to comment on the caller with the whitetail of canines.
Yeah.
It's a recessive gene trait. It's kind of like the same thing that causes albino deer. It's really rare, but I've actually seen it myself. He's right. They look like little vampire teeth. They're like a wolf would have or something, kind of pointy. And they do pop up. And I there's a guest just the other day, actually, that touched on that. They're talking about albino deer, but it's the same thing. So it was a recessive gene trait that just pops up every so often.
Cool. Well, so it is unusual. At least I've never seen it, but apparently does happen. So not only was that big buck a trophy rack, but it had a weird dentition, too.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for straightening that out, John.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate the call. And let's see. We have an email from Tim. He said he found a wasp nest under a bush and left it, and he came back a few days later to find it. Something had dug it up, and the nest and the wasps were gone. He wondered what eats wasps.
Skunks.
Ah.
Would be the likely possibility, but if he... He left it alone, apparently. So I was thinking he might have buried it. You know, if the,
no,
if the
wasps,
if the wasps were dead from whatever, then there are a number of things that might scavenge it. But skunks are notorious for that. And I don't know where he. Well, he was in a no.
No,
I
don't We don't
doesn't
know where
say. But of course, you know, bears will sometimes dig up and maraud a bee or wasp's nest too to eat the juveniles that are in the comb. So, but my guess would be skunk.
Steve in Antioch, Illinois, emailed to say he spied a blue jay standing near or in her nest, clear as day, mimicking the territorial screech of a red-tailed hawk.
It's a common imitate. Blue jays are really good at imitating a lot of things, and one of the things they imitate very well is a red-tailed hawk. So if you think you're hearing a red-tailed hawk, but gee, I don't see a big bird soaring around or sitting in a tree. It's probably a blue jay, a pretty common thing in my backyard.
And there's one other that I was trying to find. Kate, you want to pull up a little bit on that? There was one about a screech, speaking of screeches.
Yeah, something he heard at
night. Screeching at night.
I didn't think it was an owl.
Yeah, that was Todd in Delavan.
Probably isn't, and generally speaking, after years on the program in the past, layer, we often turn this one over to Phil, because especially now, late summer, with warm, humid nights, which we've been having, there are a number of night-calling insects that get up in a tree and make some horrendous noises. I think one of the ones Phil talked about was a snowy tree cricket, and katydids, and there are others that make some weird sounds at night that are often, the assumption is, oh, it must be some sort of a bird. But I think it's not. It's probably a big bug.
This is a time with all this rain in southern areas of Wisconsin where you got to be taking care of your bird feeders a little bit now, too.
Yeah, I need to do that. Maybe if the rain ever stops this afternoon, I notice a lot of my tube feeders have been so wet and soggy, I've got sunflowers sprouting out of the bottom feeding ports in the feeder. And that is not good for the birds. It's conducive to mold and fungus and all sorts of problems. So I need to take them down, flush them all out with the hose, and if it were a little closer to winter, I'd treat them with a weak bleach solution to just make sure they're clean, air dry them, and then refill them and put them back up with fresh seed once it dries out a little bit. But that kind of clogging up with gunk and bird droppings and assorted other things is not good for the birds, so clean them out before you move on here.
And you're not going to be back for a couple of months, but so, you know, we've got fall cleanup things to do here in this last 45 seconds, Scott.
Wow, 45 seconds. Well, I mean, the bottom line is try and think like an animal here as fall progresses. What are they going to be interested in over the winter? One is shelter, so they're going to be trying to get in underneath your deck, into the foundation, into the soffit, into the chimneys, whatever. Take whatever steps are necessary to put on a chimney cap, cover holes and openings and gaps and screen the deck, do that kind of thing. And then take some steps if you've got some new landscaping in that you don't want the deer or the rabbits browsing on. Screen it with hardware cloth or whatever else it takes and get after those voles just before the snow flies with some mouse traps, or they're going to chew up everything in your landscaping before next spring. So
there you go. You know what I did with my deck? I took the deck out and put stone.
Well,
and that solved all my problems. I didn't have that problem anymore. Scott, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. He'll be back in a couple of months. David Drake and Jamie Knack will be back next month to talk about the world of wildlife as well. Tomorrow, our consumer protection specialist will be back with us. At the top of the list, IRS scams. That's tomorrow at 11. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.